This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. President Obama used his State of the Union address to call on Congress to raise the minimum wage, pass immigration reform, and not to interfere with international efforts to dismantle Iran's nuclear program. Obama also warned that he'd sidestep Congress if necessary to take steps to reduce the wealth gap between rich and poor. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us today to talk about the State of the Union address and other headlines in the world of politics. You can join our conversation. Our number is 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Ken, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be with you, Jay.
And I realize we're 30 days in, but it's the first time you're on for 2014, so Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
And we're going to start out, as always, with your trivia question.
Well, we have the State of the Union on Tuesday, and of course, everybody likes to talk about winners and losers. So why not talk about great winners in Ohio history? So therefore, it's a two-pronged question, or at least with two answers. In Ohio history, and it's fairly recently, so I'm not going back to the 1800s, of course, but who, in percentage-wise, who was the biggest winner in a race for governor and a race for the Senate in Ohio?
So percentage-wise, biggest winner in the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race in Ohio.
Yeah. Okay.
That's right.
Okay. Howard's thinking.
Yeah.
I can see his wheels turning.
Okay.
And
I'm always
nervous
when you say Howard's thinking.
Yeah. So am I.
And if you think you know the answer to that question, 513-419-7100. Again, 513-419-7100. We'll let people think about that and get their calls in, and we'll take some answers.
I think I've got half the answer right now. Well, I'll get the other half.
Okay. Well, Ken, it was the State of the Union this week, and if you want to utter those words, the state of our union is strong, Howard will and I will stand in the studio and give you thunderous applause. So what?
Well, it is strong. You know, you go back to Gerald Ford in 1975 when he said, "The State of the Union is not good." Everybody says, "Wait a minute, you're not supposed to say that, whether it's true or not." So I think President Obama kind of skirted the issue. He didn't say that the State of the Union was good. He said that the American people are telling you the State of the Union is good. And there are signs, of course, that the economy is improving and unemployment is going down and jobs are being created. Of course, the Republicans will make the case that there's still millions of people who are no longer looking for work because they've just been so discouraged. So it's, of course, when you'll always, with every State of the Union address, one side will make the case, the president will make the case that things are good. The other side will say, well, yes, perhaps, but it could be better.
We'll get into some specific issues that were talked about during the State of the Union message itself, but what's your general takeaway from what you saw the other night? This was President Obama's fifth State of the Union. What's your takeaway?
Well, I guess we'll just compare it to the one last year. Go to January 2013, right, fresh off a re-election victory, fresh off a very popular inaugural address, and he seemed to have far more grandiose plans back in 2012, 2013 than he did now. It seems like, you know, to use the baseball expression, he seemed to play small ball. No longer are we talking these giant programs, these giant expenditures, and no longer is he talking about, well, you know, I mean, yes, I'd love to reach across the aisle. I'd love to work with the Republicans in Congress. And sometimes they do come through. Something, you know, we got a two-year budget plan, and, you know, there's a farm bill that was passed yesterday in the House. So that's good, but I'm just not going to just wait for Congress to sit around. I'm not going to sit around and wait for Congress to take action on issues like extending unemployment insurance and minimum wage and things like that. I'm going to do it by executive fiat. So of course, the Republicans say, you know, it's a dictatorship. It's my way or the highway. But the Democrats will say, well, you know, we've been trying to work with the Republicans for years, and that's not getting, we're not getting anywhere with that. So maybe go on our own. I thought it would be more confrontational than it was, but there are some Republicans I talked to, they said, well, it was pretty confrontational as it was.
Well, for a president with as low approval ratings as he has to come out and say, I'm going to sidestep Congress, it's a pretty bold move. Although Congress itself, the Republicans in Congress, their approval numbers are probably even lower than his.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, you can make the case that, well, Obama's numbers are so terrible, but it's great compared to the Republicans in Congress. The last number I saw, it was in single digits, although I don't know if that was just for the Republicans or Congress in general. But clearly, this is not a president with a bully pulpit. If he could not get the country or the Congress to do anything after the tragedy at Sandy Hook, in Connecticut, the shooting of children, the killing of children, and any kind of change in gun policies, right, then he's not going to come on and say, well, you know, we have to do the X or Y or Z. And that's kind of sad. I mean, basically, not that he was on the defensive, but he still made the case that, you know, the Affordable Care Act is working. And, of course, that's a no to Democrats running around the country. He said, don't give up on it yet, because ultimately this will be popular policy. But right now, as you say, his numbers are in the low to mid-40s. That's not the kind of numbers you want, if you're a Democrat, not the kind of numbers you want your president to be in, especially in the beginning of a very critical election year.
Well, a lot of Republicans obviously are crying about this idea of doing things by executive order and sidestepping Congress. I was looking at some numbers today, and really, compared to recent presidents, he hasn't used that power as much. Now, those numbers are going to pick up. I mean, the all-time champ was Harry Truman, who did it 907 times. But Truman did it because he had a Republican Congress who absolutely refused to go along with him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, probably the reason Harry Truman was elected in 1948 was his campaigning on the Do Nothing Congress, which was very effective. Those
right.
years, 1947, 1948, were disastrous for Truman. The Taft-Hartley bill, all the things that, you know, he did not like to see happen, but he did a lot of things on his own. He desegregated the military on his own because, you know, the Dixiecrats in Congress said, we're not going along with this. And he said, okay, I'll do it on my own. So the presidents, you're absolutely right, the presidents do have a history of going behind or above the heads of Congress and doing things on his own. But again, you know, whether it benefits him, of course, there's a limit to what he can do with executive action. It's not the same thing as a congressional bill, but right now Congress doesn't seem to be doing much, although there is hope. I mean, we talk about how the two sides don't talk to each other, but there seems to be some kind of a possible breakthrough, I don't know how big it could be, on immigration overhaul, and of course that fits in with the Democratic message or the Obama message of trying to work together.
That issue of immigration reform, I believe the House GOP member started a three-day retreat today, I think that's what I heard, and that's one of the topics they're going to be discussing. How likely do you think that something will happen this year on immigration reform?
Well, you know, that's a good question because, of course, you know, the Republicans keep saying, well, first the Tea Party and the conservative Republicans say, let's not look. We have the president in our hands. I mean, he's on the ropes. He's on the defensive over the Obamacare. Why give the Republicans another excuse to beat each other up, which they probably will do with immigration? But at the same time, it's clear to everybody. We looked at the numbers, what happened in 2012. Latino voters for Obama was like 75%. Mitt Romney talking about self-deportation certainly didn't help the Republican cause. And they say, look, you know, if nothing else, well, first of all, one, it's probably the right thing to do. Two, the current system is just doesn't work. And three, get this off as a Republican, as a Democratic talking point, and just get it done. Boehner, Speaker John Boehner, clearly wants to get some kind of action done, although he is saying for the 11 million people who were here illegally, he said that these undocumented people they would not have a pathway to citizenship. They would just have legal status. And yesterday, the head of the AFL-CIO came out and said, if this is not going to lead to citizenship, then big labor is out of this completely, and you just forget about this happening. So just as Boehner is in the middle of being pushed and pressured by the conservative element in this party and the more establishment wing of the Republican Party, President Obama does want to get a bill done, want to get something done, but he also has labor yelling at his left saying that, you know, no compromise on the issue of citizenship status.
Could Speaker Boehner and the Republican leadership maybe delay this decision until the vast majority of the filing deadlines have passed for, you know, their members in these states so that the vote would come after these filing deadlines so their House members wouldn't face perhaps a Tea Party challenge?
Well, I think there's a lot of Tea Party challenges going on right now, and they're filing right now. I think the bigger risk is not so much waiting for the filing deadlines, but the primaries themselves. But if you wait until after the September, the end of the primary, then you're on the election trail and nothing's going to happen right before the election. And they say, well, we should wait till 2015. But, of course, that's when the presidential election starts. And, of course, there will be tremendous pressure from the conservative wing of the party saying that we just, this is not the way to go. So, I mean, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial today that said, it's never going to be a great time to have immigration overhauls. Let's just do it now, and it's the right thing to do. And I think that's the view of John Boehner as well.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And Ken, go ahead and repeat your trivia question one more time.
Trivia question is, in Ohio history, the biggest percentage-wise, the biggest governor winner and the biggest Senate winner in election history in Ohio. And I just will give you a hint. It is not before the 20th century.
Okay. Well, you must have a real stumper because I think we have, so far I've seen one guess pop up here. And Mike is calling from Clifton. Mike, go ahead with your guess.
Before we go to, Mike's answer.
Hold on, Mike.
Hold on, Mike.
Go ahead, Ken.
Mike, could you hold on one quick second?
Sure.
If it turns out to be this difficult, maybe we'll give a political junkie button for each correct answer. You don't have to have both.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right, Mike, go ahead.
Okay. Because I'm a fair kind of guy.
All right, Mike, what's your guess?
For governor, I don't know, Senator, but for governor, it's Voinovich.
He went
against a guy named Birch, got 72% of the vote. I think it was 94.
Okay, Ken?
Mike is correct in everything he just said.
That's absolutely correct.
It was George Voinovich. It was 72%, and it was against some Democrat by the name of Birch.
Okay. Bob Birch, yes, a state senator.
George Voinovich is the correct answer for governor.
Okay, well, Mike, you get half of that right, so we're going to make sure you get...
So he gets a half a button, or he gets the whole button.
Mike, if you'll hold on, we'll get your information, make sure you get your stuff.
Okay.
So we still have the other half out there, the biggest percentage margin in a U.S. Senate race in Ohio, correct?
That's correct.
And for the record, I had that right.
Yeah, Howard did have that right.
Oh, yeah, right.
No, he wrote it.
I did. I covered that race.
He actually did, Ken.
Howard does this all the time. Oh, I knew the answer.
I write it down for Jay.
No, he did write it down for
me. I covered that race, actually. It was
But poor. I don't think you've written down anything for Senate yet.
No.
Uh-oh.
Okay, and next time we do this show on Skype so I can see
right.
<you.
laughs> I covered that race, and Ken, I ended up feeling very sorry for Rob Birch because he tried and just nobody cared.
Ken,
I'm
a reporter. You know that I will tell the truth.
Yes, that's right.
That's right.
So let's go back to the State of the Union address. The president gives his remarks, and then you have a response from the GOP, and also the Tea Party also had a response. I didn't see the GOP response. From what I'm told, that was mostly focused on Obamacare.
It was, but it was really less about what Kathy McMorris Rogers, the congresswoman from Washington State, she's the fourth ranking Republican in the GOP leadership in the House. It's less what she said than how she said it, because this is a no-win proposition for anybody in the opposition. Of course, the president stands before Congress and he has the applause every 9 seconds. And even though he has a vice president who makes funny faces, he still, does very well. Whereas the opposition speech, the rebuttal, is usually in a quiet room off the Capitol with, no pomp, no circumstance. And we always focus on, since we're bored to death about the response, because it's written in advance of what the president has to say, there's really not a real true rebuttal. So we focus on the theatrics. We giggle when Marco Rubio last year reached for a bottle of water in the middle of a sentence, or we giggled when Michelle Bachmann in her Tea Party response a few years ago kept staring at the wrong camera. So, I mean, we journalists are not superficial at all, but sometimes we do, lose interest in these kind of things. But Kathy McMorris Rogers was solid, and she didn't make headlines, and she wasn't going to make headlines. But the Republican Party is having the Republican Party is having problems with women. We saw that with Mike Huckabee the other day in his address to the Republican National Committee. When he talked about women's libido, why Republicans still talk about women's reproductive rights as if it's a foreign language. I don't understand that at all. But so having a friendly, normal-sounding, logical-sounding female for the Republican Party made a lot of sense.
What about this issue? The one thing that has come out of this was the executive order to raise the minimum wage for some federal contract workers, and that would be new federal contract workers. Is that going to be enough to budge Congress to increase the minimum wage for everyone?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you saw that President Obama was going to raise it to $10.10 an hour from the $7.25 that it is now. But I think what's going to budge Congress, if anything is going to budge Congress, is the polls out there, which show that an overwhelming majority of the American people, including Republicans, say that $7.25 an hour is just not sufficient. And it's been the same for years. And, you know, every time, like last year during the State of the Union, President Obama said Congress should raise it to $9 and nothing happened. But each time this gets unresolved, the polls indicate more and more people say, okay, enough is enough. It's time to do this. And so, yes, Republicans will say that, well, if you increase the minimum wage, there will be fewer people hired. There will be more burdens on small businesses. And there is, you know, probably some anecdotal evidence to support that as well. But ultimately, I think the guiding principle will be the fact is that, you know, the American people want it, and it's really not much of a big loser for the Republicans if they went along.
And it has been since 2009.
Right. I mean, the fact is that people's incomes are not keeping up. There are so many millions of people who, as I said earlier, have just stopped looking for work because nothing is available. And, you know, there are true conservatives who say that, you know, just upping the minimum wage is not the way to better, you know, to help the workers out of a job. But right now it seems simple enough, and it seems like it's just like same-sex marriage. You can make, you know, not too long ago, even Democrats, Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, everybody were against it. They just said it was, you know, it's just not time yet. It's a marriage is between a man and a woman, but the public opinion has shifted on that, and it seems to be shifting clearly on increasing the minimum wage as well.
Can we take anything away from where the, and this has become common too, after the president delivers the State of the Union address, he goes out on a roadshow, if you will, and President Obama did that yesterday and I think again today.
Right.
Can we take anything away from the places that he's making his stops in this tour?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about electoral votes, probably not. I mean, because yesterday he was at a Costco in Maryland, and Maryland will not go Republican in our lifetimes ever again.
Yeah.
And, you know, today he's in Milwaukee and Nashville. But like what he did yesterday in Costco, I mean, we went to – and also a steel plant, I think, outside of Pittsburgh. He just talked about that, you know, these people just need a better wage, and I think Costco – I think pays their employees at least a minimum of $10 an hour. So I think he went out to say that this is working, it's working well, and it's a very good place to work. And so they just basically he's trying to make the case that these companies get it and Congress doesn't.
Yeah, I mean at this stage you don't have to worry about the electoral votes. He has to worry about the image that he projects and going to a Costco, you know, a company where they do pay. Up to, you know, what the minimum wage that he wants is, makes a point.
You know, exactly. And then, but the problem is that, first of all, as far as Congress doing anything, first of all, it's not going to happen in the House. The House is not going to act before the Senate does. And right now, for it to pass in the Senate, they need five Republicans, and not one Republican has come out. And I mean, even the most moderate Republican has not come out for increasing the minimum wage to the $10 or the $10.10 as President Obama is calling for. And for it to happen, you know, some of these Republicans, perhaps some who are up for reelection this year, may just have to be swayed. But right now, they have not been.
Before we move on, we've got another guest on the trivial question. We're coming to that in just a second. Before we move on from the State of the Union address, how relevant is the address in an era where we have near instantaneous communication with social media and, you know, the president wants to address the nation anytime he can? Is the State of the Union address still as relevant in our times now as, say, it was maybe 40, 50, 60 years ago?
Well, you know, that's a fair question. I still think that more people talk about the State of the Union the day before or the day of than they do the day after. Ultimately, the anticipation is great. Here's what President Obama needs to say. Here's what the president must say because his numbers are bad in here and he needs to rally his party. And then ultimately, it's forgotten. I have this Political Junkie podcast this week, and I had Paul Glastris, who's a former speechwriter for President Clinton, who was on the show. And we went through old, great State of the Union messages in history, and it's hard to remember that many. I mean, you know, of course, inaugural addresses are once every 4 years. State of the Union is every year. But aside from, as I said earlier, Gerald Ford saying the State of the Union is not good, Bill Clinton saying the era of big government is over, Richard Nixon saying 1 year of Watergate is enough, and 1 year of Richard Nixon was enough because he was gone within a few months, and Ronald Reagan talking about the shuttle astronauts, things like that, Lyndon Johnson, the war on poverty, and George W. Bush talking about the axis of evil. So we remember those lines, but ultimately, do we remember the speech? Do we remember serious action that follows the speech? For the most part, no.
That's it.
Who am I talking to? I forgot who I'm talking to. Oh, it's Ian Howard, I'm sorry.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, and you had a two-part trivia question, and we've already got the first part. It was the Ohio gubernatorial candidate that won by the largest percentage, and now we're trying to determine the U.S. Senate candidate right. in Ohio that won by the largest percentage. And Jim from Fort Thomas, you have a guess. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
I'm not sure about if he got the largest percentage, but he did get 82 of Ohio's 88 counties in 2010, and that would be Rob Portman.
Rob Portman, Ken.
That is not the correct answer.
Rob Portman.
No. Okay.
I mean, he did carry it, but the statewide,
but you're right about the count.
Not that big. It was closer than actually many Republicans thought.
All right, Jim, we appreciate your guess.
All right, thank you.
And if you think answer to that half of the trivia question, 513-419-7100. Again, 513-419-7100. We're going to take a short break.
Can I just say one thing?
Oh, sure.
Sure.
If the answer was Rob Portman, you know that Howard would have said, oh, yeah, I wrote down Portman. You know that.
Look, it's not on my sheet.
No, he did not write down Rob Portman.
I did write something down, though, Ken.
We are talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. It's Political Junkie Day, and we've been talking about the President's State of the Union address. We're going to move on to other happenings in the world of politics. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. And we're still working on the second half of a trivia question that Ken Rudin gave as we started the show just after 1 o'clock, and that was the largest percentage win for an Ohio gubernatorial candidate and an Ohio U.S. Senate candidate. We got the governor part. That was George Voinovich.
Yes.
We're still working on the U.S. Senate candidate part. And Antonio from Forest Park has a guess. Antonio, go ahead.
Is it Howard Metzenbaum?
Is it Metzenbaum?
Howard Metzenbaum is not a bad guess, but no, it was not Howard Metzenbaum. Matter of fact, one of the people that Howard Metzenbaum beat pretty decisively was a guy named George Voinovich.
That's right.
People remember back in 1988. But no, the answer is not Metzenbaum.
All right, Antonio, appreciate your guess.
Thank you.
And so we're still waiting for the elusive answer. 513-419-7100. We'll get some others lined up here and get those guesses on here in just a little bit. Let's move on to some other things. We can't have a political junkie on without talking about Bridgegate in New Jersey. What are your thoughts on Bridgegate and as it relates to Governor Chris Christie?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, clearly, we just saw a new poll by the Washington Post, ABC News, talking about Republican front runners or hopefuls for 2016. And, of course, that field, the Republican field, is completely just unclear at the moment, and nobody knows what's going to happen. But Christie's numbers have clearly taken a hit, and it seems to basically ratify what many people have felt about Chris Christie for the longest time, that he just does these things out of spite, out of retribution, that he's a bully. And the latest story, we're no longer talking about the bridge gate at the George Washington Bridge in Fort Lee anymore. We're now talking about pressure on the mayor of Hoboken that she was not going to get any Hurricane Sandy disaster aid unless she agreed to this development project, this multi-billion dollar office complex in Hoboken that Chris Christie really wanted. And if she didn't sign on it, she wasn't going to get the Sandy aid. So those kind of stories is almost what we hear over and over again about Chris Christie, that it's, you know, this is what he wants, and he'll do whatever kind of tactics he can think of to make it happen. And, you know, that may, you know, some people like the fact that he's, you know, he stands up and he's a strong guy, and he likes to make fun of the teachers and the unions and the reporters. But ultimately, I wonder how that will, how much of that act will play on the 2016 presidential landscape. And it's just not good for Christie. Now, he's, of course, the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, and he's running around the state, running around the country campaigning on behalf of Republicans who are in trouble. He will raise a ton of money wherever he goes. But, you know, there are still questions about him, and whether you know, if fundraisers feel that he's just damaged himself, then his support will dry up very quickly.
But if more of the stuff keeps coming out and there's something that ties him, you know, absolutely directly to the Fort Lee situation, I mean, he's going to be in free fall, isn't he?
Well, he is, only because he said he had no idea about it. He said that his aides betrayed me. They did it behind my back. I had no idea, and that's why I got rid of them. But, of course, if you can trade, you know, this is – I mean, I don't want to do Haldeman and Ehrlichman all over again, but, I mean, if this can be traced back to the governor, then, of course, his credibility is gone. And with the Democratic-controlled state legislature in New Jersey, the I word, the famous impeachment word that we, of course, heard in 1973 and 1974 in Washington, we could very well be hearing again in Trenton.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We've been working on the second part of a trivia question about which U.S. Senate candidate in Ohio won by the largest margin, and we must have opened up a floodgate because now we've got all sorts of guesses, or people have been Googling or
lined up now,
searching on the web to find the answer. Let's see. Sally in Madeira, what's your guess?
My guess is John Glenn.
John Glenn, Ken.
Sally is correct.
Yes.
And Howard wrote that down.
I wrote it down.
69% in 1980. By the way, just for the record, Rob Portman had 57% when he won in 2010. But Sally is the correct answer.
Very good, Sally.
So, Sally, did you go out and look that up, or did you?
Look, John Glenn used to be an astronaut, right? Are we talking to Sally Ride?
I'm old, and I just remembered.
Okay.
Well, so this is not Sally Ride, a fellow astronaut of John Glenn.
No.
Okay.
And I covered that race, too, and it was against a fellow by the name of Jim Betts. Who was
Jim Betts, that's right, James Betts, that's right.
Right, and he was a former basketball player at Ohio State, and he bore an uncanny resemblance to Jerry Ford.
And the time before that, he beat a guy named Ralph Perk. Nobody ever heard of him since. No, of course, he was the guy who, wasn't his hair on fire or something? When
he was the mayor of Cleveland. He was at an industrial show, and he set his hair on fire with a blowtorch.
And he didn't go to the State of the Union because his wife said it was his bowling night?
That's right. Exactly.
All right. Well, Sally, if you'll hold the line, we'll make sure you get your stuff.
Thank you.
All right, Ken, we got the trivia question out of the way. This week, Florida Congressman Trey Radel resigned, and of course he has roots here in Cincinnati, growing up here in the tri-state. Of course, after his pleading guilty to, I think it was possession of cocaine in the District of Columbia,
3.5 grams.
He said he wasn't going to resign. He went to rehab, came back briefly. Was that one of those things? I'm not going to resign, but then it's just a matter of time before, you're going to resign.
Well, you know, he was convinced he didn't have to resign. He said, unlike so many other politicians who came up with crazy excuses, he said, look, I have a serious problem. I'm an alcoholic, blah, blah, blah. Not to excuse it or anything, but, I mean, he owned up to it from the beginning. But the problem is the reaction, you know, that kind of contrition didn't help with any of his fellow Republicans. Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, the Republican state chairman, many other Republicans say, no, you've got to go. Sure, it's rehabilitation is fine, but you can't represent our district in Congress. So the pressure on him was overwhelming, and he just, you know, lost his support. And I think the Republicans are very glad that he did resign. He resigned effectively as of Monday, and it's just one less thing. You know, I mean, a lot of times that you think you might want to stand behind somebody you work with, but one, he's only been there for a year or so, and two, you know, both parties just want to get rid of embarrassments as soon as they can. Yeah. When Bill Jefferson, the congressman from New Orleans, found to have, like, you know, $80,000 in his freezer, you know, the cold cash jokes, Nancy Pelosi said, look, get out of here, you know, go as fast as you can, and he wouldn't resign. He had to lose an election before he left Congress, but that's what happens.
I don't think anybody in the Republican caucus was looking forward to an ethics investigation into Trey Radel, so that problem has gone away.
No, absolutely not. I mean, again, as we said about the immigration and unemployment insurance, the Republicans still believe that the issue in 2014 is the Affordable Care Act, is public problems with Obamacare, and they just don't want anything else to distract them. So if it means, you know, disassociating themselves with Trey Radel, you know, so be it. But Radel was in trouble to begin with. It's a solidly Republican seat, but he was not going to survive a Republican primary this year anyway.
Speaking of politicians who are in trouble, what can we take away from the indictment of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell?
Well, it's pretty remarkable in the sense that once upon a time he was talked about, you know, a potential running mate for a Republican president, if not a presidential candidate himself. He won in 2009 with an overwhelming majority, and he came in very popular. But these allegations of that, he and his wife, they took furs and they took jewelry and they took gifts from this developer who got, you know, perhaps a quid pro quo from the governor. Of course, proving that is very difficult, but it still means, you know, he's still indicted. He's still, his political future is completely finished. And it's something that, you know, this was once somebody, a leading light. You know, it's funny, the two Republican governors who were elected in 2009 were Chris Christie and Bob McDonnell, and both of them, the stars have dimmed, shall we say, McDonnell probably forever.
Today we found out that 20-term California Democratic Representative Henry Waxman is going to retire. Does that have any practical effect on the Democratic chances of winning back the House?
No, that is an overwhelmingly Democratic seat. Henry Waxman has held the seat since 1974. He could have held it until 2074 if he wanted to stay there. But, you know, there was another Democrat from California, George Miller, who was also from the class of 74, who also announced his retirement. The district is not going to go to Republican. No way in the world will it go. Perhaps they're just exhausted of Republican rule, and there's no sign that the Republicans are going to lose their majority in the House anytime soon. Democrats need a net gain of 17. It's hard to do when you have President Obama, a Democrat, in the White House. I mean, the Democrats theoretically could pick up some seats, but not enough for a majority the way the districts are drawn. So maybe they just felt like, you know, it's not going to get any better. I might as well, you know, leave, you know, not go out, you know, legs first.
When I heard the news about Waxman, I thought about George Miller, too. And, you know, those two are the last of the Watergate babies, the ones that came in 1974 after Nixon resigned and, you know, in the midst of the aftermath of the Watergate scandal. And that was a big generation of Democratic members of Congress who came in at that time. And those two were the last two standing.
And they were both very effective. I mean, they had a tremendous career. What Henry Waxman has done on health policy is probably unequaled among very few members of Congress in history. George Miller, also on education and poverty and children and, you know, education stuff. So, they had a long career in 1974. It was a long time ago. I guess they've done everything they can do. And perhaps it's just frustrating. I mean, I can't speak for them. I don't know their answers. But, you know, being there for four decades is a long time, and they have, you know, nothing to hang their heads in shame about. They did amazing jobs, and they go out with a tremendously impressive record.
Speaking of longtime lawmakers who are retiring, the Arizona Republican Party this week voted to censure Senator John McCain, and apparently he was considering maybe retiring. Now he's saying because of that action, he may indeed seek a sixth term in 2016. What's your take on that situation?
Well, it's, you know, we have seen this in a lot of Republican parties around the country that many, I mean, the thought of John McCain being a liberal or a moderate is just, you know, beyond the pale. If anybody, I mean, you think of look, whatever you think of Mitch McConnell, but he stands up to President Obama at every opportunity. John McCain, he did have his flirtation. The media had his flirtation with John McCain in 2000, but that's when he was running against George W. Bush. He obviously became much more conservative to get the nomination in 2008. But, you know, there's still folks back home who say he's still soft on immigration. He's still soft on many things. He's still too willing to work with Democrats. And the state party, I mean, censured him. We see that with Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, too. He's a conservative, but a lot of the new Ron Paul kind of leaders in many state parties, they just don't share McCain or Lindsey Graham's affinity for an activist foreign policy. They still feel that McCain is still looking to fight another war, and the new breed of Republicans are the kind of groups that say, no, this is crazy. We have too many problems at home, and an activist foreign policy is the last thing we need. So, you know, I mean, whether he runs again, who knows? Again, 2016 is a long time from now, but this is the kind of thing that would just, you know, fire up McCain, but it's hard to imagine John McCain not being fired up in any event.
But it's almost hard to imagine in the current climate in Arizona, John McCain might not get reelected, would you think?
Well, of course, the demographics are changing, right? And there was a Senate race in Arizona last time where the Democrat lost a very, very close election. This was for the seat John Kyle was retiring from. And, you know, John McCain did face in 2010, did face a serious primary from J.D. Hayworth, the former very conservative congressman. But McCain adjusted, and became really moving to the right, and it helped him. But ultimately, moving to the right, it makes sense in Republican primaries. It may not make sense in the future of Arizona. And so there are a lot of considerations before John McCain makes a decision about 2016.
Since we last talked, Liz Cheney has decided to quit the race to be a U.S. Senator from Wyoming. Was that any surprise?
Well, yes, in the sense that I know that Dick Cheney was calling everybody he knew in Wyoming. And, of course, one, he knows a lot of people in Wyoming. And, two, there are not that many people in Wyoming. But regardless, I mean, he really wanted Liz Cheney to have that seat. There was really no problem with Mike Enzi, the conservative three-term senator who Liz Cheney was going to challenge in the primary. But, you know, she was a new brand of leadership. She was, you know, more aggressive. And it wasn't about ideology. It was more about just generational. And we're seeing that a lot in some part in primaries. Lamar Alexander in Tennessee, Thad Cochran in Mississippi. These are pretty conservative senators, but they've been around a long, long time. Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. So a lot of the argument is less so ideology, and both are very, very conservative in Wyoming, but it was a generation of new leadership. Now, she, of course, the fact is that every Republicans know each other in Wyoming. Enzi has not done anything to alienate them, and she picked the wrong target. Had he decided to retire, which was always a possibility, she would have been a great candidate, and she still may become a great candidate, but she really divided many families and upset many loyalties in Wyoming, and there was tremendous pressure on her to get out.
The Congress approved, the president signed the budget spending agreement earlier this month. Now attention focuses on the next vote, which could be raising the debt ceiling. Do you expect fireworks around that decision to raise the debt ceiling?
Not the kind of fireworks we saw back in October, which, you know, when that battle was part of the reason the Republicans shut down Congress, shut down the government. But But and there seems to be some indication that President Obama he and the Democrats for the longest time have been saying that, look, we're going to raise the debt ceiling and there's going to be no compromise. Mitch McConnell has been saying, and the Republicans have been saying, well, look, everything is a compromise. You can't just get what you want. You can't say stamp your feet down and say this is my way or the highway. We have to compromise. I don't know what the Democrats are going to give up on this, but just as Harry Reid said, we wouldn't compromise on extending unemployment benefits, and now it looks like there will be a Democratic compromise. Perhaps the Democrats will find some way to appease some of the Republicans. But by the way, the first bill, even before that, will probably be the farm bill. The House passed it yesterday. The Senate is likely to pass it next week. And while it doesn't satisfy everybody, it's tremendous cuts in food stamps. And, you know, tens of thousands, of hundreds of thousands of people will be without. It's probably the best that both parties can do. Democrats didn't want the cut in the food stamps. Republicans wanted more. And so they compromised. And, you know, $8 billion out of the food stamps program is pretty severe. But they got a bill, and they hadn't had a farm bill in more than 2 years. So, you know, whatever it is, if there's some kind of compromise that could be worked out, it's a sign that maybe the impossible can be possible in this current Congress.
The Republicans wanted a whole lot more cut out.
Oh, absolutely.
Of food
the original bill, I mean, originally
like
when the House passed it, they took out food stamps completely from the farm bill, and they were talking about what some people call draconian cuts, but they compromised on $8 billion, which, again, more than the Democrats wanted, less than the Republican conservatives wanted, but it's still, you know, they got a deal.
Were you surprised at all that they compromised on that? Because they were really hard line about it, the Republicans in Congress.
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, I listened to some of the debate, and there didn't seem to be much argument for more cuts. The fact is, it's still cuts. There's still good reform. There's still, you know, supporting agriculture subsidies.
Right.
There seems to be less waste than ever before. And I think even conservative, Frank Lucas is the chairman of the House Ag Committee from Oklahoma. He says, look, it's not all I wanted, but it's more than conservatives ever dreamed of, and we should go along with it. And that argument carried the day.
Someone wants to know, do you think the current popularity for Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear will prompt him to look for a national office after he leaves the governor's office? He says no, but he sure is getting an awful lot of national attention.
He is getting a lot of national attention, and my guess, if anything, he gets appointed to some big cabinet position, either in Obama or a subsequent Democratic president. But he's been around a long time. He's up there in age. He's run for the Senate before and lost. He got clobbered by Mitch McConnell, I think back in 96 or something like that. I take him at his word he's not going to run for any office, but I know that there are a lot of, I'm sure there are people in the administration, either the current one or perhaps President Clinton, will look at Steve Beshear as somebody who could play a good role in the government.
Well, the other day at the State of the Union address, President Obama put Steve Beshear in the First Lady's box.
He's a perfect example of that. Yes, there are some problems with the national federal rollout of the Affordable Care Act, but there's many indications that states have been successful, and they point to the program that Beshear is running in Kentucky. And while the sign-up, it still has some of the sign-up problems that the national program has, it's still seen as a success. It's still seen as ensuring many people who otherwise would not have been. And, it's hard to be that old. I mean, I don't know how old he is. I'm sure he may be in his late 70s or something. But, you know, it's never too old to finally reach the pinnacle. Look at Jerry Brown in California. He's going to be 76 years old in April, and he was, you know, laughed at for so long, considered Governor Moonbeam a flake, and yet he has turned around California like no governor in recent memory has. You know, they have a surplus, which people thought would never happen. So, you know, there are second lives for these the elder statesmen.
Ken, just in about 10 or 15 seconds here, once I get this question out, we referenced the Washington Post ABC News poll. Hillary Rodham Clinton had a huge lead over Joe Biden and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Is that a position that she wants to be in the 2016 race for president?
Well, I'd rather be Hillary Clinton than Joe Biden when I look at those numbers. Of course, you know, there is the fear of peaking too early, and she is certainly peaking too early. She is, by almost everybody's stretch of the imagination, the almost assured nominee for 2016, which is very strange that when you have a sitting Democratic vice president. But I can't see any way in the world that Hillary Clinton bid for the nomination is in any kind of jeopardy, and I think Joe Biden knows that too. I don't know who he was pointing to at the State of the Union, but he wasn't pointing to his pollster. I know that.
We've been talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin. You'll find links to his podcast and blog on our website, WVXU.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We appreciate having you join us each day for the discussion. We'd also like to get your thoughts on the show. Please go to WVXU.org and take part in our listener survey. Archives of our programs are available on our website. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Bruce Ellis, who also got today's trivia question right. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.